It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Today is Sunday, May 28th, and this is Celtics Beat on the CLNS Media Network, the leading online provider of audio-video coverage of the Boston Celtics. I'm Adam Kaufman. Episode 520 features former ESPN fantasy basketball writer Seth Landman.
And I'm Evan Valenti, and this show is powered by FanDuel. Go to FanDuel.com/Boston to get a no-sweat first bet up to $1,000.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I kind of can't believe we're doing this, but I can believe we're doing this, and this is just incredible. And part of me is out of words, and yet we're going to find a way. We are going to find a way. Welcome into Celtics Beat, a Game 7 preview edition in the Eastern Conference Finals. Boston back home. The Celtics, who have won 3 straight games, now will battle the Heat for a chance to return to the NBA Finals. And there are so many reasons this show is happening exactly the way it is happening right now. So Evan Valenti is here, obviously. I am Adam Kaufman. We're generally always here. At least one of us is always here. Seth Landman is back here for a litany of reasons. Now, one, and hi, how are you? It's good to see you again.
Are any of them about what a great guy I am?
None, not a one. It's much more superstition. You're kind of this show's lucky the leprechaun, maybe. you have come on to preview each and every series so far. You've come on to, you know, in it's like right before game one of each series back in round one, Atlanta, round two, obviously Philly, and this round with Miami. And if, in fact, Boston pulls this off and advances to face Denver, another team that you are quite fond of in the NBA Finals, then you will be right back with us for our very next show in a couple of days, because, as we know, the NBA Finals begin in just a few days. That is set in stone. It is locked in June 1st. That is game one. And it would be in Boston, again, if the Celtics do manage to pull this off. But why you are here ahead of that show, if that show even happens, and specifically for this show, is again, superstition. You and Evan, when these two teams met in the Eastern Conference Finals last year, and I was in a hotel room in Disney in the quiet trying not to wake my family, I did not do the show. I was on vacation, but you guys together did the show previewing that Game 7, and as you have already flashed at the video for anyone watching versus listening, you drank. You spent about 90 minutes in a very dark place trying to envision how that game was going to go. Yeah. It was really a compelling listen. I did really enjoy it.
One of the darkest ever episodes.
But it was fun. And look, to the listener, I mostly guarantee we won't go 90 minutes. But I did want to make sure I almost considered stepping aside. Maybe some of our listeners wished I had, but I wanted to make sure that the two of you were back together again, previewing a Celtics Heat Game 7, and hopefully some of what happened last year follows us this year and we get a return trip to the NBA Finals. But before we largely preview, I don't want to do too much looking back, because enough shows, radio, TV, podcasts, whatever, have already done that. You've gotten everybody's opinions, and everybody's opinion was, oh my God! So we don't need to do that again for you. But I do want to touch on a little bit of what, you know, without a full debrief, just a little bit of what went down in Game 6 and the fact that this game is even happening in the first place. Seth, we'll start with you, obviously, being the guest. Your emotions of that game when Boston really seemed in control until about, what, four and a half minutes left in that fourth quarter, when it very clearly slipped away. Jason Tatum, who was incredibly aggressive. I mean, two-pointer after two-pointer, attacking the basket, getting to the line like he could do nothing wrong in the first half. Second half, no points in the third quarter, largely invisible, comparative anyway to the first quarter, obviously. And, you know, he did other little things. I'm not saying like Tatum, you know, flaked or something, but he largely invisible offensively compared, obviously, to that first half when he had 25 points or whatever it was. And then slips away. The last 2-minute report we can dive into a little bit. I know you have thoughts. And then obviously Derek White sends everybody, you know, well, not everybody home happy. The game was in Miami, but Celtics fans elated across the nation. What were you thinking as this thing was playing out?
That game was so many different kinds of games. You know, we have all these cliches for understanding games as they're happening. I'm sure you guys do this too. The lead isn't as big as we think it should be. Like, you know, Miami's making all these threes. The Celtics are playing really beautifully in the first half. What do they end with, a 4-point lead or something? So it's like the cliche at this point is that you say they should have a bigger lead than they have, right? Like we have all these narratives that we tell ourselves as the games are going on in order to understand what's happening. But it did feel, and actually I would argue it stayed this way, although the end of the game in a similar way to last year's game 7, like slipped away in some very, what I think are very similar ways. But the Celtics, I would say, stayed in control. I thought they controlled pace really well. I thought they played a really, really incredible defensive game, like even down the stretch in some cases, except for a few things that I'm sure we'll talk about, like losing 3-point shooters on screen actions. But yeah, this felt like a game where the Celtics were in control, maybe should have had a slightly bigger lead than they had. You can forget this now, that they lost the lead early in the fourth quarter also, and then built up another lead. It was just a real roller coaster ride. And then, I've been trying to figure out, like, if my last time I was on, I think we talked about my negative mind, like the way I get negative about things.
Yeah,
and is that why I couldn't tell that Derek White's shot was good at the end? Like, is it just me being negative that I didn't even let myself? It looked late to me. Like, I swear to God, I saw the light go off. Like, you know, I know what to look for, but, you know.
Well, I think part of it is that, correct me if I'm wrong, but, and I certainly don't have a statistic to back this up, but when you just think about it as a basketball fan.
Yeah.
After, you know, years of watching.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the time that happens, like that, you know,
the tip in,
the prayer and the tip in at the buzzer, the majority of the time it's not good, it's late,
right.
So at least it feels that way. Maybe I'm statistically wrong, I have no idea, because it certainly feels that way.
You hold for the last shot, right? It's like when you're down you're not really supposed to, but with 3 seconds left it's 6-1, half a dozen of the other. But
right,
yeah, no, I think you're right that like often the play that you try to run, and part of what happened here is that it was a broken play right from the inbound pass. But the play you try to run takes a certain amount of time, and it's usually the amount of time you have left, right? Like that's kind of how you draw it up. You try to plan for an offensive rebound. I mean, you got to give credit to not just White, but Tatum. I think like both of those guys go so hard at the rim after that shot goes up.
Yeah. And Tatum saw him, and like I love watching the replay. Everyone's watched it 1,000 times. But Tatum goes up with him, obviously, because they're both chasing the board, like you said. And he saw White with a better angle, and he just quickly backs off. Which, you know, I don't know, if White had fumbled the ball or something, people would have found a way to criticize that, because that's just the way it works. But I thought that was a really heads up play by Tatum.
Yeah. To have the wherewithal to even bother crashing the glass there, I think you see, like, I just can't imagine being, like, smart enough about anything that, like, I see that shot go up and my instinct is to crash the glass. Like, I can't imagine not just staring at that shot like a moron, you know?
That,
like,
that 3 seconds, though, is, like, the perfect encapsulation of why we all love Derek White, right?
Yes.
He inbounds the basketball and immediately jumps to the corner to give Marcus more space.
That's right.
And then just immediately crashes the glass. Like, he doesn't stop moving. He inbounds the basketball, moves to the corner, and then just automatically crashes. Like, this guy does so many little things naturally. like without thinking. He just does them on a basketball floor. And that's like the thing that Seth, I know you were very pro Derek White trade. Adam, I know you were very pro Derek White trade. I was very pro Derek White trade. When you watch San Antonio highlights, when they made the Derek White trade,
yeah,
they're filled of all of those type of plays. You're like, oh, this guy's like kind of a, like the perfect pickup basketball player. Like just does a little bit of everything.
Feel.
Like
he's got great, great feel.
Just a, it was 3 seconds.
Cliche, but just high pure, basketball IQ.
Yeah,
smart
IQ
basketball
feel, yeah.
player.
Yeah, yeah.
It's awesome. And like the thing is, and Barrett talked about this on our last show, White's made three threes in at least every single one of these games. He's been absolutely
including
nailed.
A sixer.
Yeah.
Absolutely nails this entire postseason for the most part after what was a tough one last year. Like the narrative surrounding Derek White is so much different because he's obviously significantly more comfortable playing with his team.
Yeah.
And like when they lose a major piece like Brogdon, because that's a major piece, like that's the sixth man of the year right there. They have the depth to have Derek White, who was their third best player on the team this regular season, by the mm-hmm. way, step up and just be huge. He's been, and again, it's a joy for me. It's a joy for the rest of the guys in this particular show because we all believe in Derek White. This was just like
– it was a vindication.
This is just another day for us. But for those that doubted, man, I mean, what a way to win the hearts of Boston right there. And it's – what's funny is, Seth, as you were talking about, is it my negative mind that I first just went to the it's not good? That's the worst possible outcome like you could possibly come up with, like to get to game six, like
I know,
have game six play out the way it did and to lose because you didn't get the tip in enough time and you melted it away in the fourth quarter. That's the, like, you don't even get to the game seven because we all talked right. about, oh, this is going to go seven, like the fact that it's here. The fact that you didn't get a chance in game seven mm-hmm. to make history, like to lose it with point whatever, like not enough time on the clock. If you just had point one more seconds, that would have been the difference between not going to game seven and going to, like, it was the worst possible outcome. And the fact that it's not made it yeah. so much sweeter, boys.
Well, and on sort of, if we're going to pull it back, I promise this will be a momentary lapse of vibes. This is a vibes show. More
no,
than
we're anything. Going vibes here. No, you'll notice well, me and Evan with our glasses here.
I want you to pull me back. Yeah, I want to negative mind something really mm-hmm. quickly because it's just sort of eating at me a little bit because, you know, I'm all over Twitter and I'm seeing like all of the,
brilliant discourse coming up.
Not even that, like the manufactured gifts of like Derek White on Dave Roberts' head sliding into second, and you know, or like Jimmy Butler being Jeter, and you know, all that, like all these, you know, people comparing it to Bird steals the ball or, you know, Butler's interception in the end zone and all of these things. And where my, for right or wrong, okay, like I hope they win game seven, win the title. Like I hope this is the Robert Steele, meaning it is the catalyst to, you know, like they don't lose again this postseason. They win eight straight like the Red Sox in 04. Like how wonderful would that be? But, and tell me if I'm wrong, please tell me if I'm wrong about this. If they lose game seven, God forbid, if they lose game seven.
Oh yeah.
Isn't White's play kind of suddenly meaningless?
Yeah.
Like, isn't,
doesn't
I mean,
suck?
Like barely even gets remembered. If you get to the finals and lose, but you get there, White's play goes down in infamy still. But if you lose game seven, White's play suddenly is
disappears.
Just, it completely vanishes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing about sports is like, it does matter if you win or not. And it shouldn't. Like, okay, what a game like this is supposed to teach us is that luck is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so these are my, this is what I wanted to get into. It's related to what I wanted to get into about the last 2 minute report. So like, maybe I'll talk about this a little bit. Like, I was thinking about
eviscerated the officials, by the way.
No,
this particular last 2 minute report.
It was not great. But like the one I want to talk about is like Tatum getting fouled by Vincent on that drive. Yeah. Cause like that drive was a really interesting play in a lot of ways. But the last 2 minute report version of this, like if you give Tatum two free throws there, that's like another place where the game could kind of be over. or like not over, but it's just like 2 points there makes it just a much, much more difficult and totally different comeback than what is going, than like what they're in the middle of at that moment. And like, and then White, and then Butler making all three free throws is a huge play. I mean, Horford.
Yeah, when it should have been a foul on the floor, include, you know, not a shooting foul according to the last 2 minute report.
No, they called it a shooting foul on the last 2 minute report.
But I, did they?
Yeah. No, they said it.
Maybe correct. I read Washburn's tweet wrong. I thought Washburn's tweet said
no,
they,
correct like, call they on the shooting the foul. Correct call on the shooting foul and correct, and that they got the time right. It should, yeah.
All right.
But like, but certainly, certainly you could argue it the other way. Like it's definitely close one way or the other. Mm-hmm. Butler going to the line and making all three free throws. That's another like one of these moments that could go like lots of different ways. Like we've seen like really good free throw shooters can struggle to make all three, like in the middle of meaningless games. Like the three free throws thing is a weird thing. And then of course like Derek White having this like miracle rebound putback. So like, Duncan Robinson missing two threes, two wide open looks.
Wide open.
So like, what the point being, you could play the last few minutes of this game out in all these different ways. And in like half of these ways, Miami could win the game. And in half of these games, the Celtics could win the game. And what it comes down to is frankly luck, in a lot of these close games. And we never want to believe that. Like, we keep saying this thing about how Miami is just like inherently good in close games. This has become like a narrative throughout the postseason. But we see when we look at multiple seasons lined up back to back to back, it does tend to be more about luck than we like, than we want to believe that it is close games. And so I think, so where I wanted to go from there is that I was so charmed by what Tatum said after the game. It was like the first time in his career that I've seen him really embrace like, that the like luck and joy in that way. He was like bubbling over. It's like something about the absurdity of this game got through to him in a way that made him like really feel how special it is to win a game like that, how lucky you have to be to win a game like that, and to have the opportunity. He, what was the quote he said about like, I've never been this excited to go back to Boston and play a game,
right?
Like that's an amazing thing to say after a game like this. That's someone who is like, who's not just like using like ridiculous, like sports militarized rhetoric to like talk about how like we have to be tough and blah, blah, blah. He's like, I'm excited to go play this basketball game. Like, I just thought that was so cool. And I think, but like, who knows what it means in terms of the on-court product, but I think it bodes really well in terms of his attitude going into that game and maybe the whole team's attitude. I just think like, you know, like refs get calls wrong, like all this stuff. It just like none of it really. It comes down to luck in a lot of ways, and we'll see what happens. Like, but as a player, are you willing to embrace that part of it? And I think Derek White crashing the glass there is like a version of embracing luck. It's like, I don't know if I'm going to get this playoff before the buzzer, but I'm going to go for it and see what happens. It's like you just see what happens.
That's, I thought it was a lot of, too, like, just piggybacking off of that, another thing Tatum said in his, both on his on-court TV interview with ESPN or whoever it was, as well as, you know, post-game talking to all the media, was, you know, his love for this team and this group and the camaraderie. And, you know, a skeptic could say that, you know, he was saying that stuff in the wake of like Kevin O'Connor's report and trying to, you know, dismiss stuff like that. No, we are a unified group and, you know, F that noise and all of that stuff. But it certainly didn't feel that way. It felt incredibly genuine. And I, you know, part of this is in, and this isn't a Celtics thing. This is a sports thing. Like, one, winning cures all. Like, there are plenty of teams that win titles across sports, across decades, that the players don't really like each other. They just gel really well together on whatever, the field, the court, the ice, and they find a way to get it done. And again, they are bonded. They are unified in that way. You know, we've had conversations privately, like over text, you know, talking about some of these reports. And, you know, you've made the comment like, I don't know, I buy into some of it. I think there's certainly some possibility that these guys don't like each other as much as we would like them to believe they like each other. And what I sort of, you know, and I may have said this to you, I don't remember, and I've definitely said it in other places, but what I sort of hearken it back to is, you know, these guys, the core especially, mm-hmm. have been together for so long. They have been through so much. They spend more time with each other, be it games, practices, traveling, on the road, whatever, than anybody else in their lives. Families, friends, anybody. And like, who among us can sit here and say, and I include the listener, the viewer, that like you love your spouse, you don't always like them, you know, like you battle with your siblings, you get into it with family members, you like, I said to you, Seth,
high
like
school buddies.
I love you like a brother. I probably couldn't live with you. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, so man. I just think that like some of these things get so overblown in the context of, can these guys put all of the crap aside and win? Can they, mm-hmm. can they be successful on the floor and win? And I think this is just a much greater point. I think it speaks to a lot of different things. We can go in whatever direction you want, or we can ignore it entirely. But I think it's the people want to get into the whole, can the Jays win together? Can Smart be part of this core? Can Joe Mazzulla, like, do they hear Joe? Are they willing to play for Joe? Well, for all of the people that have been clamoring for him to be fired, or, you know, they've tuned him out, he has to go. He, like, never mind the whether or not he's a good coach. You can put all that stuff aside for a moment and just the, has he lost the room and all of those things. You don't come back from down 3-0 to force a game 7 if you don't believe in your coach, like, in any way, shape, or form. Like, you just, that doesn't happen. Talent to me, maybe you disagree, talent to me does not so far greatly outweigh a 3-0 deficit and a coach being like incompetent and like, this guy sucks.
You 100%. Know, But on the other hand,
I'm rambling, but go ahead. I think that there was so much more in what Tatum said post game than has even properly been acknowledged when it comes to like the psyche of this team.
I agree with what you're saying. The texture I want to add though is that I also think you could say that you don't fall down 3-0 in the series in the first place.
Sure.
If that is not a problem in some way. And so I think there's like what I keep coming back to is that there's an inherent contradiction there, in that like a team is never exactly what we think that it is. Like, you know, like the Warriors over the last like decade are a good example of like a team that like we still talk about them, and rightly so, like given what happened in last year's finals, as like a group of guys who have like the heart of a champion, right? Like we say, like people say this stuff, but like, Does a heart of a champion team go down the way they went down in 2016? Like, mm-hmm. does a heart of a champion team blow a 3-1 lead to LeBron? Does a heart of a champion team have like one of their best players kick a guy in the nuts and get suspended for a game? Like, you know, like they make dumb mistakes too. And like most champions do. So I think it's like always just a little more complicated. Like, I actually agree with both things. I think like, a team that is like not listening to its coach and isn't resilient and tough can't do what the Celtics have already just done in this series. But I also think a team that has those qualities can't be necessarily be down 3-0 in the first place in this series. So I think like, I don't know how you square that. It's really wild.
Think about it though. This is a similar conversation that we had last year because the series, there's time in between. We have so much time to like mm-hmm. marinate on every little detail of a game, and a game is only 48 minutes. And yeah. if you like string together 3 bad games in a row, you have all the stuff that everybody was saying after game 3, and it all sounded fine. I was one of the very few, like, I don't think you should fire Joe. Like, it's his first time doing any of this stuff. And he's quite literally, he's still learning on the job. I think it's remarkable that he's gotten this far while still learning on the job.
And he's then 34.
He's like, let me just show you guys what I've been learning this whole time. And all of a sudden, a Topgolf outing later, and Joe Mazzulla like saying, you know what? Like, my favorite thing is this team just decided, like, yeah, we'll spot the Miami Heat 3, and we'll start adjusting, and we'll start using timeouts differently. And like, when we're really our backs up are against the wall, then we'll start doing things differently.
Like, we're just unbeatable in elimination games.
Yeah, it's like, have you guys heard of timeouts? These things are amazing.
It's so crazy how everything has flipped.
And the latest fad is
quickly.
Yogging, right? Maybe it's Soft J, maybe it's
it's crazy how quickly this flipped to me.
It is.
And it's like, and this is exactly the Seth's point. Like, it's never this thing or that thing. It's actually probably somewhere in the middle of this.
Yeah.
Coming back down 3-0 to force game seven proves that Joe Mazzulla is actually like okay at his job. He's not perfect, obviously. He's sure. not like he's going against the best guy. Eric Spoelstra is again to pull out the zone with like 4 minutes to go for the first time in the game when things were really desperate. Like that was crazy smart. Like that was incredible. He just does stuff. And Joe's learning, unfortunately, against a team that has a lot of continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys know how to play with each other. He's going against a guy who's been to countless amounts of big games, NBA conference finals games, NBA finals games, and how to do stuff and learn on the job. Like, I don't know. I think what's funny is the difference in tonality of this show this year versus last year, I think is
very Yeah.
Because,
well, all right. So let's, I want us to talk about game seven and really look ahead to game seven and you guys can continue to funnel your drinks while we're doing that. But first, Ev, thank the great people who have us here twice a week in the first place so that we can do this multiple times during the playoffs each and every week.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
So let's talk about game seven.
Game seven.
I don't generally have what I guess I would like to call blind faith. I absolutely did in 2004 as it related to the Red Sox when they were down 3-0. And if Twitter had been around at the time, I mean, I was telling everybody I knew, I was sure the Red Sox were going to come back to beat the Yankees. Never had never happened. Who gives a damn? I just felt it in my bones that they were going to come back and win that series.
What was the formula? It was in game four and then
It was Schilling you had, in game well, yeah, Schilling.
In game then, four because we got Pedro in game five, Schilling in game six. Anything can happen
in game seven. Okay, right. Thank you.
Yeah, so, but again.
Favorite part of my childhood, no big deal.
But again, blind faith. It was shouting into the sun, praying it was going to happen. As it comes to the Celtics here as a mildly more mature man in my, you know, young 40s watching this team and being a little skewed by the business and working in sports and all of that and just the general negativity that I think we're all burdened by as we get older in some ways.
As a great man once said, the negativity in this town stinks.
Right. So I don't look at game seven in any sort of blind faith, hey, they're coming back home, they're going to win sort of way. I do believe Boston is going to win, but it is rooted in this. I said it on this show, I've said it elsewhere. I believed that if they won game four in Miami, we would see a game six in Miami. That right there that's as close to blind faith as it gets regarding game five. It was, if they win game four, I just think there's going to be enough at home to carry them back to Miami in game six. But then I don't know what's going to happen in game six. That was what I said at the time. After those two games played out, I had all the confidence in the world in game six simply because of the way they were defending and the way they were shooting. What has me confident in game seven now is, well,
the defense.
Do you guys know?
They won
do you guys
game
know
that
what,
nobody's ever won before?
No, because that teeters into the blind faith. Do you guys know what the Celtics shot from three in the most recent game?
Oh, yeah, got to memorize.
If you take Smart and White out.
Oh, would it be? It's either one or two for, I don't know the denominator.
Wow. 0 for 17. If you take White and Smart out.
Smart made four, White made three. Is that right?
That is correct.
Wow.
0 for 17. Tatum went 0 for 8. Brown went 0 for 4.
Each made 3.
Horford 0 for 2. And Williams, Grant 0 for 3. 0 for 17. So call this blind faith if you want, but I don't categorize it this way. I believe they will win game seven. Not just it, like momentum isn't even really factoring into it unless you believe the Heat are mentally soft, and I don't. What it is this. I believe they will continue to defend the way they are. I think they have a plan. They're going to keep doing it. And I just believe that the way they shot in game six, coming back home, there's just no way they're going to shoot that poorly from three in game seven. I just don't believe that. We saw it in game four. We saw it in game five. I believe we will see it again in game seven. And also role players, historically speaking, tend to play better at home in, you know, in these playoffs, in like playoffs in general, not just this year. I just believe that we will see, and that doesn't mean Boston's going to win by 20 or something, but I believe Boston will win this game because I just think you will see a better overall offensive performance from this team that they than they had in game six. I mean, there were so many ways, you said it, Seth, there were so many ways that they won game six by virtue of luck, you know, and
well, luck and great defense. Yeah.
Great, for sure. I don't want to like they escaped.
Yeah, yeah, they did.
And I think they will win game seven, not escape game seven. I think doesn't mean I'm taking the points, Ev, but I think they will win game seven against Miami because I believe they will shoot better. And I believe that the crowd at home matters, even despite what their playoff record over the years would tell you at home. And I think, you know, like Grant to me can't continue to be this bad. I just believe that. Horford, you know, again, offensively speaking, defense has been great, but offensively speaking, I just expect to knock down a three or two. I think some, and I don't, I'm not someone who believes that White is going to keep, I've been wrong every time. I don't think he's going to keep hitting 3 3 pointers every single game, but and Tatum is not going to go 0-for-8 from three. That's just not going to happen in game seven. So if you want to accuse me of some of this, like blending into blind faith, but I just believe that they are going to be better.
I don't think you're out on a limb suggesting they're not going to have. They just had like the worst three-point shooting game they've had of the season. I don't think it's like
20%.
Yeah. So I mean, they're going to make like it's always a good bet. Three-point shooting is different than two-point shooting. And over again, we see in the numbers that teams are likely like the best bet for the next game is that they find their water level like the hot streaks game to game don't tend to really exist usually with 3-point shooting. And so, or they exist, but like, it's not a good way to determine what's about to happen. And so I think, yeah, the best like guess is that they shoot somewhere between like 35 and 40% on threes. I would be more concerned about the denominator. Like I think they need to take more than 40 of them. And I think like, you know, they got, I don't, was it because they're not making threes or what? Like they did a great job of like scoring in the paint. I think like, you know, one funny thing about that play where Tatum, that the last 2 minutes said Tatum report said Tatum got fouled. When Tatum and Brown attack off the dribble without an advantage, we've heard me talk about this on the podcast before. I'm obsessed with this. They lose the ball a lot. On that play, you can see Jimmy thinks he's getting Tatum from behind. He like does the reach around thing. He tries to slap the ball away after Tatum's by him. And Tatum was like paying attention and did not. You can see him like focus on not losing the ball when Butler goes for that steal. That I feel like Butler was getting roughly 100% of the time on other plays. So, I mean, like, you know, they were doing a great job of going to the basket. But when they're at their best, it's weird to say about a team, but when they're at their best, they're just doing like really, really simple stuff. And like a lot of people made the point that Spo was like bringing a little more pressure on the Celtics, a little like double teaming Tatum occasionally, like at the top of the key. And that in games four and five, Tatum was doing a good job of getting off of it early. So like as soon as that double team comes, one of the adjustments Mazzulla made was to bring someone rather than having him have to make like a really great pass out of that double team, bringing someone up to the perimeter so that it's like a really easy pass out of that double team. And what you see with the Celtics is that when they just make one pass, like one simple pass, the ball gets moving. Like they make the next pass, they make the next pass. There was a play in that game where the ball got all the way back to Tatum and it like, really good stuff when they pass the ball. I got a great stat for you here. In this series, this is my favorite. I can't believe this, it was true when I looked it up. So in this series, if you look at passes per possession for the Celtics, they're averaging 3 passes per possession in wins, 2.64 in losses, and their three highest games of the series in passes per possession are the 3 wins, and the 3 lowest games in passes per possession are the 3 losses. When they, like, more passing is really good for the Boston Celtics, especially when those passes are just like easy, like just swing it around and see what little crack forms. And then as soon as they're at any advantage, they have like 5 or 6 guys who are incredible at attacking an advantage. They don't have guys, I think kind of Tatum and Brown included, who are like great at attacking when they don't have any advantage yet.
There's a play that reminds me of, and it's actually one with Jaylen Brown where Jaylen
swung it around the entire perimeter.
Corner, went all the way around, found Jaylen again. It was the hook play where he got hooking, but the ball.
But literally every dude on the floor touched the ball.
Touched the ball after Jaylen touched it, which is not something that happens that often with Jaylen Brown.
Yeah.
Usually it finds Jaylen Brown and that's usually where it stays. But it was one of those things. It was blind trust where this, again, everybody touches the basketball. And that's when the Celtics are at their best, is when guys are moving, guys are cutting, and everybody's having a little taste. And it's annoying that they don't do that all the time, but it's also like kind of hard to play that way, because at the same time, Boston clearly knows they have certain advantages on certain guys when they get certain switches. Yeah. Like, let me see if we can find a way to tie into this particular game. Because we've talked a lot about Game 6, and we haven't talked a lot about Game 7.
Well, that's what I was trying to say about Game 7, though, is like more passes. That's what they need to do.
That's the thing. But one of the things that I've noticed is, and it came through last game specifically, is Tatum was killing Jimmy Butler when Jimmy got switched on Tatum. And I'm never going to count Jimmy out. I'm just not, as much as people want to count him out. I'm like, unless you beat Jimmy 4 times, he's still got a chance. And I'm just not going to say that he's going to lose. But I'll say this, like, Jimmy kind of looks tired. He just looks a little tired. And Tatum putting him in the torture chamber.
Bam, too, by the way.
What?
Bam, too, by the way.
They played 46 and 47 minutes last night.
Yeah, I pointed that out. People were wondering why I pointed that out last night and couldn't put 2 to 2 together. Anyway, when they get certain matchups, like when Jimmy's on Tatum, like, I think Tatum's like, I'm going at this guy. This guy can't guard me right now. He's exhausted. And so sometimes that harmony gets broken up because they have certain advantages. Like, and so it's annoying. I get it. I get people get frustrated, but at the same time, like, go play a basketball game at this level and then understand how hard it is to win games like this.
And I think
it is hard.
And I think it's so, I forget, like, it's, I think it's also so hard when you're great at something to give up your control. Like, I think this is what they deal with. I think it's really hard to do, to know, like, okay, I have the ball. I already have the ball. Like, I don't have to even pass it to have the ball. And there's someone in front of me I think I can beat one-on-one. And so I'm going to pass the ball and, like, risk turning it over instead of just, like, doing, like, going at it right now. And I think the blind faith part of basketball is that you, like, have to involve your teammates for reasons that are not clear in the moment. It just works. Like, we just have evidence over years and years of time that, like, when everyone's involved, the ball, this is why people like Steve Kerr say, like, mystical things, like the ball finds energy. And, like, you know, these things that you hear coaches say, it's because they're trying to find a way to explain this thing that makes no sense, which is, like, you have to move the ball, even sometimes when you already have the advantage. You just have to do it.
Yeah, I just think so. I gave my opinion. I think they're going to win Game 7. If you guys are comfortable putting that into the world, I don't know. I mean, what is your feeling about this game? Not what they 60, need to 40? Do to be successful. All right.
That's where I'm at.
Can we get into another topic that is one of the things I think is fascinating about this particular show are the parallels between this year and last year, and what Seth and I talked about this year and last year. Rebounding one more time, Seth. How crucial is rebounding for this basketball team?
And they got kind of killed in Game 6, actually.
Yeah, and the offensive
17
glass.
17 on the offensive glass for Miami.
Yeah, and like, look at some of the stuff that bought, like, What, Jalen had what, 5 offensive rebounds in game 6?
He did. Well,
can I add a little texture to this though? Because you know how I keep yammering about how
Butler and Bam each had 7, by the way.
Yeah,
you know how like the Celtics don't force turnovers. This is like a thing we've talked about.
Except for game 5, where they forced a ton.
Well,
of them?
I think one of the adjustments in this series is that Miami was really comfortable in the first 3 games, and like part of the reason they're shooting the lights out is that they're just comfortable, and so I think one of the adjustments Joe made is to amp up the pressure, but you can see like the cracks that creates, like, by amping up the pressure, you're more vulnerable. Like, you're more vulnerable to giving up offensive rebounds. You're more vulnerable to the cracks where they're getting these open threes, because usually either Jalen or Smart is getting lost on these picks. You know, those are plays that happen because you're trying to amp up your pressure and be more aggressive. And Spo talked about after the game that like the Celtics, many times in the game, the Celtics did have them jammed up. I think it's hard not to say it was one of their best defensive performances, but I think some of shooting 14 for 30 on threes is luck. And some of it is that maybe you're getting some, like, I mean, the things that made you make Miami only shoot 30% on twos are freeing up some outside shooters. And that's why they're shooting like, you know, 40, whatever it was, 7% on threes. I don't know. It's like all these things go together. You change one thing, it changes everything else.
I'm not asking this the right way, because I don't want to do the whole like lazy who's the X factor in game 7 kind of question. I watch these games, and in this, I feel like I need to say this in a certain context. The scariest players on Miami for me personally, when I'm watching the game, are Caleb Martin, Gabe Vincent, Duncan Robinson. Like, it's not Jimmy and Bam. I know what Jimmy and Bam do, and I don't worry about those other guys that I just mentioned full on taking over a game, even though we've seen Martin do it a couple of times.
We sure have.
It's just sort of their general existence on the floor and knowing what they are capable of. And just anytime the ball leaves their hands toward the basket, I gasp in a way that Butler or Bam, as good as Bam is in the mid range, or as good as Butler is at getting to the hole and all that, they, like, the Celtics could lose game 7 with Butler going off, and that would surprise nobody.
Mm-hmm.
But he still does not frighten me in quite the same way as those other guys do, simply because I guess it goes back to this. I've said this on the show a number of times in this series. I just kind of feel like, to a certain degree, you can let Butler get his, and you can let Bam get 20. You got to control the role players. And if you don't control the role players, you're probably done. And so it's those guys, like we talked about Robinson, the multiple open looks that he missed toward the end of game 6. It's those guys, Seth, that just, they scare the ever-loving crap out of me, in the same way that, like, you know, like, Tatum and Brown need to be Tatum and Brown in game 7, most especially Tatum needs to be Tatum. But, you know, like, then White and Smart are in a different category. Allen, Grant are in a different category. Like, if Grant has 15 points.
Oh, yeah.
Miami's in a ton of trouble.
Yeah.
You know, otherwise no one else is doing anything, and that just doesn't make any sense to me. But, you know, I don't know. Like, we've seen the Grant game in the same way that we saw the Kelly Olynyk game. Like, it has happened before. But, well, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Isn't this why we talk, like, this is why we talk about Philly the way we talk about Philly? Like, that you can, this is why, like, my whole point about Embiid being guardable. It's not that I don't think Joel Embiid is, like, perfectly likely to score 40 points if you guard him the way I would suggest guarding him. He's going to put up 40 every game if you guard him that way. But what's not going to happen is he's not going to get anyone else going. Like, no open looks are going to be created if you single cover him, stay at home, just don't foul, let him make a million shots. Again, there was the game where he scored 50 whatever points against the Celtics. They won by 2 with a bunch of the Celtics' best players not playing. So anyway, I think it is largely true. Like, Jimmy is an amazing facilitator of other people. Miami is great at having all these 3-point shooters run off a million screens and get open. And Jimmy and Bam are great at finding those guys. And so I think with Jimmy, it's like those guys are going to give you what they give you. Like, it's not a surprise when Jimmy or Bam kill you. But like what kills you is you like overreact to that. You bring more help. And suddenly those guys are getting like wide open looks. And I think when we were talking about Derek White, we talked so much about his 3-point shooting and we talk about his defense generally. But I think like one of the most impressive things he's done in the series is just how much better he's got. It, first of all, it's can you imagine being an opposing team and the decision you have to make is that you have to attack Derek White, a guy who just made the first team all defense? Like,
not ideal.
So like that's the decision they have to come to. And for three games, Jimmy Butler was destroying him, just shooting over him, making every shot. And Derek White got better at it. It's not like it's not a question of effort. It's a question of just getting better at doing the thing, like over time. And this is why basketball series are amazing. Like there's no like secrets left. Even the adjustment with the double screens that was springing all those Miami shooters open for threes in game six. Like they see it. They've seen it now. Like, game seven is going to be, it's going to come down to like some of it's going to come down to like will and effort and all that stuff. Some of it's going to come down to execution. Some of it's going to be make or miss league stuff. And then some of it's going to be, and then what we hope is that all that stuff evens out enough that the fact that the Celtics are a more talented team carries the day. Like all things being equal, the Celtics will win. But all things aren't equal in basketball. So that's why it's like, you just never know.
48 minutes.
Yeah.
It's going to be a coaster.
Do you know the on-off numbers for Tatum in this series? Have you guys looked at this?
Plus 10.4.
So the raw numbers are he's like they're plus 15 with him on the court for the series and minus 23 with him off, which doesn't sound that ridiculous. But when you think about how often he's on the court and how often he's off, it means that they're plus 3.7 per 100 possessions with him on the court. And this is wild. Minus 26.5 per 100 with him off the court, including a defensive rate. Miami scores 141 points per 100 possessions when Tatum is off the court.
I wanted to bring that up before we left.
48 minutes, right? We need 48 minutes.
I know we're running out of time. I would like to spend a little bit of time just talking about like the what Tatum is doing at age 25, and then like if you look at some of the stats that he's involved in right now, you're talking about all time greats here. I mean, he is what 30-10-5. It's the most since LeBron in 2018. For one postseason run, that's pretty remarkable. When you're ever in the conversation with LeBron James, he has the most points by anyone in the playoffs through the first six seasons of their career. Pretty wild. He's just doing a bunch of historic stuff. And I got really mad the other day when, and this is just me being stupid, and it's Colin Cowherd playing to me. He got me good on the, like, you know, we don't talk about Michael Jordan's game six because it was after game six against the Sixers. He's like, we don't talk about Michael Jordan scoring whatever points in game six against whatever. Like, we don't talk about that. I mean, I forget the part where Tatum skipped like a whole bunch of guys and is now on the Michael Jordan, LeBron James like sort of level. But what we're seeing with him is truly historic. And it's to luck out with the Philly draft's faults instead. Like it's pretty unbelievable that Boston has probably the guy you'd want if you didn't have like Nikola Jokic as your centerpiece. Like I love Steph Curry, he's incredible. Giannis is an incredible basketball player. But last night after watching that game and all the stuff that you now can compare Tatum to, like, he's just a top five guy. And it's like Jokic, Giannis, Curry, and then Tatum for me. Because at this point, with all the success in the postseason, the two straight first team All-NBAs, the two straight top five MVP finishes, and then what matters more than anything else, his team is around at the end of these seasons. And if he makes one more NBA Finals, if they find a way to get through Game 7, I'm just going to throw it out there. Jason Tatum probably has something to do with the fact that they went on to go to the NBA Finals. he is a special player, and as much as we analyze everything about him, he is like kind of the perfect guy. Like he is all about basketball. Seth was talking about how it was kind of fun to listen to him after the game because it was pure joy, and it was.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate that this is the guy for the Celtics and not anybody else, because he's accomplished way more than most. And I'm talking 99.9% of NBA players at age 25. Like he's been amazing. And I don't know the whether it's like he's tied Larry Bird for this amount of points. You're talking about,
I mean, he's already, you know, never mind playoffs, but he's already recorded the most, you know, the highest single season points average in Celtics history.
25.
You know, to bring it back to last year, Evan, I feel like we spent a bunch of time talking about opportunity. Like, we ended up coming around to this. I feel like we ended up coming around to this idea that we were just like, it was so cool that the Celtics had this opportunity to like play this game 7 and maybe go to the finals if they win it. And that's like something about last night's game, about how crazy it was, just about like, about how absurd everything that happened down the stretch is, like just continuing to miss those shots and like every insane thing that happened. And then Derek White making that play that we'll remember for the rest of our lives, probably. Yeah, it just made me, it, like, I kind of felt how Tatum felt. I was just like, oh my God, like, I've been so, like, miserable watching these games. I've been, like, tearing the hair I don't even have out of my head. And, like,
I was very drunk like, last night. As I
like, it's so cool. Like, we root for a good team. They're, like, good. They're good every year. They just, like, they have a shot at mattering every year, and we get to root for them. And that's cool.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny too. I haven't told you guys this because it's not important, but it's a fun little whatever. So as you guys know, I had people over watching the game, and not just friends, but like my kids had friends. And so it was this big, like all of, you know, of various ages, and, you know, my 10-year-old and 8-year-old staying up, obviously wicked late, 11, whatever time it was the game ended, and watching this thing and just sharing this moment with them, obviously. But I'm sitting there in the chair, and Butler hits the three free throws. And obviously there's the timeout. And I have my phone sitting next to me, and I get, you know, like certain reporters I have notifications on for. And if there's one guy, and I don't blame him for it at all, like plenty of people do this, I'm just singling him out. Washburn is like, he's definitely like one of those guys above anyone that like the first tweet of something that happens in the arena will be from Washburn, without a doubt. And he happens to be someone I have notifications from. So I'm waiting for the play to start. You got to remember, like, he's in the building, so I'm way behind watching it on TV. And I'm twitching. Like, I'm just so nervous and pissed that this is about to end, you know, and the way it's going to end. Not even that it's going to end, the way it's going to end.
And dumb foul, by the way. Anyway, I'm sorry.
I see my phone light up, you know, with the notification, you know, it goes from black screen to notification pops up. And I don't even know why I did, but I glanced down. And I just see a tweet from Washburn that says, oh boy, or oh my, or whatever, or like something like that. And like the Celtics haven't even inbounded the ball yet. And I'm going, and like, I'm looking around, and like, obviously nobody else in the room that I like has a clue. And I'm like, are they going to do this? Are they really going to do this? Like, how's it? And I see Smart shot go up, and it misses. And then in that millisecond, obviously, I'm thinking like, was Washburn's oh my, they came that close, like the shot went halfway in and then popped out. White play, obviously. And I was like, oh, just the roller coaster of emotions that happened inside that 30 seconds of my life was beautiful. Really something.
Yeah, I didn't watch the free throws, and by the time Derek White's shot counted, I was on the ground. I was literally screaming and sitting down. Like a child. Derek White, again, like 15 straight. My voice still isn't like totally all the way back from that. It was something else. This has been a special run, though. This has been a very special run.
I had two friends over who don't really know each other. Shouts to Ted and Jake, and they, none of us thought the basket counted, and when we saw the replay, you could see it like clearly in the moment where we saw it clearly out of his hands before the light went on. We like it. It was like there was like high fives and like touching and hugging. And like, it's like these people don't even know each other, like, you know, but that's what sports does to you.
It's why I always say, and everybody always says who's a sports fan. This is not unique to me, but I always say if you don't love sports, I feel like I can't even relate to you. I don't get it. Like if you don't feel something on a level that only sports can create for you, like true sports fandom, because it's not even, if you're just watching a game, but it was between two teams you didn't care about and you saw the exact same thing happen,
different.
You'd get a rush, you'd get a jolt. But you wouldn't feel it the same way. You know, you wouldn't absorb it. It wouldn't be part of you. It wouldn't prevent you from sleeping at night one way or the other. It would just be like a cool moment. Right. You know, something you might mention, you might text someone, hey, did you see that?
Yeah.
But this like shockwaves across friendships when something like that happens. And it was so unreal. All right. If I can, because we do have to go. We've been long. But if I can pull this back to what you were just talking about, Seth, with Tatum and the on-off, because it's obviously an alarming differential. He played 44 minutes in game six. Had to. In game seven, if this is close, and look, it'd be great if he plays 35 and it's a blowout win. But if this is the close game that most people would expect it to be, I mean, is this a full 48 for Tatum? Does he put, or if he is out, when do you do it? You know, and I know some of that is just feel of the game, but what, you know, and like what the lead is at or deficit or whatever at a given time. But I mean, he's going to play the vast majority. Does he play at all?
I think I think the way you do it, or it seems like the way coaches do this, and I'll use Jokic as a comparison point, because I think him and Tatum tend to have the same rest patterns, like when they sit. And so the way I've noticed is like those guys will play the entire first quarter of a big game. Their coaches will try to get them. If there's like a break, like 30 seconds to a minute before the end of the first quarter, they'll try to get them out, see if they can get them a couple minutes around the quarter there, and then sit them as long as they can in the second, which usually is like a minute or two in a big game. I think Tatum was back in like right at the 9:45 mark, basically in both halves last night. And then my guess is if it's a close game that he doesn't come out in the second half. I mean, these national as every coach loves to bring up, these national TV games have a lot of timeouts and the timeouts are long, and maybe this is an argument for Joe hanging on to some timeouts down the stretch so he can buy some rest. But like, you know, there's like reviews happen, blah, blah, blah. Jimmy and Bam each played, 46, 47 the other night. My guess is that we see Jimmy, Bam, Tatum. And honestly, I wouldn't be surprised to see Derek White up there. I don't know if Jalen works the same way. Like, the Celtics,
Tatum, Smart, and White were the only guys to play 40 plus in the last game.
The Celtics kind of survive okay. Like, I think Tatum and White are the two guys who like need to be on the court for like just keeping things moving, sort of, and what they do defensively.
Smart too. I don't want to do a whole thing about this, but he's such a polarizing figure. I like, there's no happy medium. Nobody is just like, yeah, he's all right. Like, people either love and defend him to the death, or people can't stand him and want him gone. There's just no in between. But I don't see how you can watch these games and not recognize the ball just, and I'm not talking defensive player of the year stuff. I'm not talking about shot selection. I'm just talking about the flow of the offense. The ball does not move the same way when Marcus Smart's not in the game.
Yeah.
Plain and simple.
I'll add to that. There's a reason that how many coaches has this team had in the last 4 years? Three different coaches. How many of those coaches consistently run post-ups for that dude out of timeouts? I mean, like, there's a reason that, like, a lot of smart people who are involved with the Celtics go to Marcus Smart a lot.
No, he's been fantastic the last two games specifically. This goes back to, I know that people don't like him. I don't understand the reasoning why, but I understand that they don't like him. But like Marcus Smart wins basketball games. Like, and when it really matters, he just wins basketball games. He can do things that you just can't. He just does, and he's been doing it ever since he was in college. If you watch Oklahoma State, Marcus Smart, this is the same stuff. He is an incredible basketball player. If you think about it, that draft is what? Wiggins, Jabari Parker, Embiid, Aaron Gordon, Dante Exum, and then Marcus Smart. If Embiid gets traded, Smart's the only guy still on the original team that drafted him. And I'm not trying to say Embiid's getting traded, but I just want to point out that Smart, out of all of those guys, is the only guy you'd go to war. I mean, I know Wiggins had a great finals last season, but Smart has so much more proof in the pudding. I'd rather go to war with that guy. Julius Randle went to a GQ cover shoot instead of workout for the Celtics. Worked out really. You talk about luck, Seth. Let's make it full circle. The Celtics nabbing Smart because Julius Randle wanted to have a GQ cover shoot instead of workout. Thanks, Julius. Appreciate
Kaufman, you, Kaufman and I love Marcus Smart, but we're never going to get over the Julius Randle thing.
No, I really wanted Boston to take Randle that year.
As someone who watched Marcus Smart in college, I was
Every time that Randle has been available since, I've wanted the Celtics to sign him.
I was a huge Smart fan in college. He was breathtaking in college. Same stuff. But like, because he could have more of an impact, even like more jarring. But I'll leave with this. This will be my last thing to say. This is the, if you look at the Heat, the Celtics, the Nuggets, the Warriors from last year, this is another notch in the belt, so to speak, for continuity.
Mm-hmm.
The team's the same. And I mean, I know something, like Philly has had a whole bunch of stuff go on. I know other teams haven't had this success, but sometimes keeping the same team together for a while, like, really works out. And Boston, Miami, Denver, definitely huge examples of that, for sure.
Well, game one of the NBA Finals is Thursday. I very much hope that on our next show, Tuesday or Wednesday, it is right back here with us three previewing game one against the Denver Nuggets in Boston. That would be the dream. But first, of course, the Celtics, they need to do their job, which is make history and come back from all the way down 3-0, win a game seven in Boston. They got the pieces. They got the depth. They got the talent. They are healthy enough to do it. Just go do what you've been doing the last few. Do it again. And we will all be able to celebrate. This has been incredible. An incredible run, incredible story, incredible fun. It can only, I hope, get better. So rate, review, subscribe wherever you get your podcast. We greatly appreciate it. We appreciate Superstition. And so thank you, Seth, for being back with us. I hope you both enjoyed your drinks. And we will be back sometime after game seven to talk about all of it. It's going to be a ride. Thanks for watching and listening.